The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Robin O'Brien, The Unhealthy Truth. What is really in our food supply and how much do government regulators actually know about it and permit it? Because things that are in our food chain are now being attributed for causing a whole series of different health issues. Well, here we are. We're coming up into tax season right now. It's a time when most Americans are thinking about paying and filing their taxes. They're also using words that we can't describe or use on the radio, but that's part of the whole process. We've discussed tax planning over the past few weeks, and this week we're going to talk about a different kind of tax, estate taxes. For most Americans, estate taxes are no longer an issue with the estate tax exemption at $5,450,000. But even though you may not be subject to estate taxes, your heirs could be facing high capital gains taxes depending on the assets you own and the type of estate plan that you have. Even the 2012 Tax Reform Act law helped to clarify estate planning. The president recently proposed lowering the estate tax exemption, going back to taxing estates for additional capital gains taxes, and eliminating several types of tax savings trusts. So, if you have accumulated enough assets and are concerned about protecting your children from harsh death taxes, or if you have a business you own and want to make sure the government doesn't force your heirs to sell the business to pay the death tax, this show is for you. So, Jim, let's begin with the current laws as they stand and what listeners can do to protect their estates from government confiscatory estate taxes.
Well, let's begin with the good news. The good news is, as a result of the 2012 Tax Reform Act, the exemption was raised to $5 million, and that's been indexed by inflation. So by 2016, this year, that exemption is $5,450,000. So the exemption gets indexed every year by the inflation rate, which is the good news. Now, anything above that amount, however, gets taxed at 40%. Now, the president, in his recent budget to Congress, wants to drop the exemption back down to $3.5 million, where it was in 2010. The president's budget proposal has 15 new taxes totaling $2.6 trillion. Five of those 15 taxes deal with estate taxes, everything from lowering the exemption to capital gains taxes on estates, in addition to the death tax, to the elimination, John, of various kinds of trusts that help protect assets from taxes down the road. So it's really important, depending on the outcome of the presidential election, that you put your estate plan into effect in case a new president goes after estates and raises estate taxes, either lowering the exemption, as the president just proposed, or taking away a lot of the special trust, or double taxing the estate from not only assessing estate taxes, but also capital gains taxes, which can run as high as 23.8% at the federal level.
All right. Well, if we look at this entire situation, let's frame it. Let's start with zero percenters, those individuals who don't have to pay estate taxes. What expenses do their estates face?
I mean, if you have less than, rounded off $5.5 million, there are basically two kind of expenses that your estate is going to face. One of them is going to be probate. For if you don't have your assets held in trust, or depending on the way you've taken title to a property, you could face what we call probate expenses. And like here in California, they can run anywhere from 4 to 2% of your gross estate. So you want to retain assets in your estate, because the second kind of tax that you could face is capital gains. And the way the law works right now, when, let's say, the last spouse passes away, or let's say a single individual passes away, whatever the value of the assets in the estate, doesn't matter what they were paid for, whether you own real estate, a business, or let's say you own stocks, they get stepped up to market value at the time of death or 9 months after. And what this does is it eliminates all the capital gains tax. Now, this was put in effect in 1981 by President Reagan because the government was taxing estates twice. They would tax them for estate taxes. Back then, the rate was 70%. And then when the heirs would go to sell the assets to pay the estate taxes, the government would tax them again on capital gains taxes. Well, Obama wants to bring back double taxation. So the way to avoid that is if the assets are held in your name, let's say between a husband and wife, husband passes away, the assets go to the wife, they're all held in the wife's name, the wife passes away, they get stepped up to market value, and that way you get to avoid the capital gains taxes, which right now could be 23.8%, although the president wants to raise that to 28%, plus if you live in a state that has state income taxes, and also you may live in a state that has inheritance taxes. Believe it or not, there's a few states that do. So if assets are retained by the estate, you can avoid the capital gains taxes because they get stepped up at death. And depending on the type of estate plan, you could also avoid probate expenses.
Okay, well, what about the president's proposal to get rid of the stepped up basis and then tax estates on capital gains?
John, not likely this year, although there are a few provisions that we talked on the show last week that he may be able to get Republicans to go along on. The Roth provisions, required mandatory distributions from Roth, that might be something that the Republicans give an inch on. But it's unlikely that any of the other proposals that would raise over $2 trillion in taxes would get passed with the Republican Congress. Now, that could change next year with a President Clinton or a President Sanders. They would actually probably be much worse under a Sanders presidency. But, you know, right now, at least for this year, it's unlikely that these things are going to get passed.
Okay, well, what about probate expenses?
Well, every state, and this is important for listeners, every state has different probate exemptions. In other words, a certain amount that you can have in a state and there's no probate expenses. So you should know your state's exemption in fees. For example, in California, if you have an assets under $100,000, it doesn't go through probate. However, anything over $100,000, the fees can start at 4% and go all the way down to 2%. So the easiest, most effective way to eliminate probate fees is to set up a simple living trust. This eliminates probate fees, but could also protect against a conservatorship if one spouse becomes, let's say, incapacitated. So it's really important with the current exemption at $5,450,000 that you should review your estate plan, which may be outdated given the current laws and especially where the exemption is today. Your objective is really your biggest expense is going to be avoiding capital gains taxes and those probate fees and the high income taxes that can be assessed on an IRA, depending on how you have set up your beneficiary provisions to your IRA. So those are mainly, John, three kind of expenses. We call them the zero percenters, meaning they don't pay zero estate tax, but they could pay capital gains taxes, they could pay probate fees, and they can pay high income taxes on an IRA.
Okay, before we move on to the 40%, explain the capital gains tax and the IRA tax.
Okay, I'm going to try to simplify this. By the way, if you have an AB trust and your estate is less than $5 million, maybe you have a $2 million estate or a $3 million estate, you want to listen to what I'm going to say now because you could be unwittingly paying capital gains tax. Let's assume that you have a $2 million estate. Husband passes away, an AB trust would split half of the assets into the B trust and half of the assets into the A trust. So $1 million would go into the B trust and $1 million would go into the A trust. Now, let's say that we'll pick on the husband. Let's say the husband passes away first. The wife is the survivor. She goes on and lives another 10 years. And for simplicity's sake, let's assume that the assets that were once $1 million over a 10-year period grow to $2 million. So the B trust would have $2 million and the A trust would have $2 million. Now, the wife passes away. She's the one that has the A trust. Whatever the value of those assets are, $2 million, they would get stepped up to market value at time of death. So there would be no capital gains. However, if there was $2 million in the B trust, where originally it started out with $1 million, there would be a $1 million capital gains tax for the heirs. And just to go to show you what this means, with 23.8% currently, which is the capital gains rate, and they want to raise that to 28, by the way, the tax on that $1 million of capital gains would be $238,000. And here in California, where the tax rates go from 9.3 to 13.3, California taxes would be on that $1 million, $91,700. So the total capital gains tax, John, would be almost $330,000 on that tax.
Okay, what about the IRA tax now?
In the IRA tax, depending on how you set up your beneficiaries, all of that IRA could be subject to income taxes at the time of death. And of course, we know what the top tax rate is. It's 39.6. Add 3.8% Obamacare tax on top of that. And then you can add anywhere from, like here in California, where the state taxes go up to 13.3%. So to make this easier, there's something called an IRA stretch. And let's just make it easy. Assume you have $300,000 in your IRA and you have three kids. Well, rather than having that $300,000 taxed in the year of death, what you would do is you would do something like an IRA stretch where you name all three of your children, and then your children could take out their portion of the inheritance, let's say $100,000. They would take it out over their lifetime, taxed at their tax rate, so you don't get that big lump sum tax, which could take almost 50% of it right up front. Now, the president recently proposed doing away with that, and it would force the IRAs for the beneficiary heirs would be taken out over a five-year period instead of their lifetime. So you can see here, depending on how you set this up, and John, this is a mistake I see happen a lot, where a lot of the heirs sometimes are surprised at how much is taken at death of an IRA if it isn't properly set up. So those are the three main taxes that if you're not subject to estate taxes, you could have a high income tax on an IRA, depending on how you set that up. You could have probate fees, and you could have capital gains. Those are the three things that affect everybody else.
All right, let's move on to the 40 percenters. What to do if you have an estate that is above $5,450,000? It could be, well, what, investment assets, a family farm, a business, or real estate, where the estate taxes could wreak havoc at death as heirs scramble to try and raise cash to pay the death taxes, which could jeopardize the family business, the farm, or the real estate assets. So under these circumstances, heirs could lose the family farm, the business, or the real estate holdings as a result of the death taxes. They'd have to liquidate them just to be able to pay the taxes.
And that was a big issue. And that's why President Reagan not only raised the exemption, brought down the estate tax rates, but he gave us the stepped up basis in cost, because that's what happened in the 70s when you had high inflation rates, when real estate was appreciating. A lot of farmers, a lot of family farms were lost due to death taxes and capital gains taxes. Now, if you're one of the fortunate few and you have assets that are above $5,450,000, there are a number of different trusts that you can use to shelter taxes for estates. We're going to talk about the most common used under $50 million. Anything above that amount, you get into more complex entities, generation skipping trusts, you get into foundations and other complex legal entities, which, you know, is a show in itself. But there are basically five types of trusts that are used. If you're over $5 million, there's the AB trust or the disclaimer trust, depending on if you're over $10 million, over $10 million, or maybe in between $5 and $10 million. There's the Q-tip trust. There are generation skipping trusts where you want to create a legacy, pass the assets. Maybe you have kids that are doing very well and you want to bypass one generation onto the next, which is what Jacqueline Kennedy did. There's wealth replacement trusts where you set up a special trust that's funded with insurance that replaces the amount that's going to be paid in estate taxes or provides the liquidity to pay the estate taxes. And then there's also something called a charitable remainder trust where you can use that. You not only shelter the assets, but it's normally done. It creates a tax deduction, but it's also done to avoid heavy capital gains taxes, like, for example, in California, where the capital gains and federal taxes, capital gains taxes, could amount to almost 37%. So it's quite high, but usually a combination, John, of these kind of five trusts can shelter and handle most trust or estates that are valued, let's say, $50 million or less.
Okay, Jim, why don't we begin with the basic trusts? I mean, these can help eliminate the death taxes.
You know, there's something that many of you right now listening to the show may have, and if you're under $5 million, you do not want to have this kind of trust because you may be setting up your heirs for capital gains. But let's assume that you have a $10 million estate or close to $11 million estate. A very popular trust is the AB Trust, because the AB Trust, when you're using an AB Trust, the husband gets $5,450,000 in an exemption. The wife gets $5,450,000. So an AB Trust under today's current laws, based on the exemption, that's assuming if the Democrats or the president doesn't change it, you could pass $10,900,000 and you would basically not have to pay any estate taxes. Now, if you're in between, let's say, 5 and 10 million, there's something called the disclaimer trust, which is used for estates under that. And this allows some flexibility to the surviving spouse. So let's say, you know, maybe your estate's worth $7 or $8 million at time of death of the first spouse. You may want to put a couple million dollars into the B trust to keep that out of the estate from being taxed on the death of the surviving spouse. So that's called a disclaimer trust, John. But between the AB trust and the disclaimer trust, you can shelter up to $10.9 million. So almost $11 million, which, you know, can really come in handy for a lot of small businesses or individuals that have real estate. This is a good, easy way to basically double that exemption and avoid paying estate taxes of 40%.
Okay, now let's assume that there are estates that are above $10.9 million, which is the maximum you can shelter using the double exemption for husband and wife. There are obviously many ways to shelter estates, or we wouldn't have wealthy families today like the Kennedys, the Rockefellers, or the Waltons.
You know, I mentioned, as we talked about, there's five kind of trust earlier. So let's go on to the next type of trust. It's called a Q-tip trust. Basically, with large estates, the Q-tip trust provides a way to defer estate taxes by taking advantage of the marital deduction and yet sort of control it from the grave by directing who will eventually receive the property upon the death of the surviving spouse. Now, under such a trust, all income must be paid at least annually to the surviving spouse. The trust can be invaded only for the benefit of the surviving spouse, let's say for medical reasons or emergency reasons, or, you know, in today's environment, if a spouse was used to a certain lifestyle back in the days when we had high interest rates, and now when we have zero interest rates, there are a lot of wealthy families that the assets don't provide the same lifestyle because, let's say, the rate of return on bonds, which are traditional type assets used in, let's say, a retired portfolio, don't provide the returns. However, in order to qualify, the executor must make an irrevocable election to have the marital deduction apply to property placed in trust. Let me give you an example of how this might work. Let's take an estate that's, let's say, worth $11.5 million. That's roughly about $600,000 above where the exemptions are today. The estate would be divided into two parts. One part would be the $5,450,000, the current exemption, that would go into the B trust. No taxes are paid on this amount since the trust would take advantage of the current exemption. However, the remaining amount, which is over $6 million, would be placed in the Q-tip trust, of which a portion would be kept in that trust, and there would be a portion that would be part of it, there would be an election to have some tax paid on that trust. In this example, let's say the tax would be $128,000. $192,000 would be in a separate Q-tip trust, which would go to the heirs. So when the final spouse passed away, the $5,450,000 in the B trust would go to the beneficiaries. The A trust of the $5,450,000 would go to the heirs, as well as the Q-tip trust, which would escape further taxation. Basically, what you're doing here is paying a little upfront taxes on the death of the first spouse to get that income into a separate trust that isn't taxed on the death of the second spouse. It's very reflective and appropriate, John, for assets that would appreciate. A variation of this was done with Sam Walton when he passed away. Before he did, he gave away some assets and he did a Q-tip type trust. So they would pay some of the estate tax up front because he knew that Walmart was growing. And it worked out well because today, collectively, there are 6 surviving Walton families. And between those 6 Walton family members, the total value of their assets are almost $150 billion. The Walton family, by far, is the wealthiest family collectively in the United States. And that was done with the Q-tip trust.
Okay, now what about generation skipping trust? I'm assuming this is what many of the large estates of this country used to do to be able to be passed on as a legacy to future generations.
And that's exactly what it's done. The basic intent of the federal estate tax system is to tax property as it's passed from one generation to the next. Now, the generation skipping tax is intended to prevent wealthy families from reducing estate taxes by skipping one or two or more generations. You know, a lot of this is known as dynasty trust. Now, the generation skipping tax is an addition to the normal estate tax. Now, let's give an example. Let's just take a figure of $16 million. And let's say it's the grandparents' assets, and they're saying, gosh, our kids are doing real well. They're going to have their own estate tax problems. They really don't need our money. We want to do something to skip one complete generation. So what happens is, let's say on the death of the first grandparent, the $5,450,000 would go into a B trust. The balance, let's say $10,570,000, would go into the A trust. Now, upon the second grandparent's trust, what would happen is there would be $3 million of that $10 million that would go to the children, and that would be paid. There would, tax would be paid of roughly about $2,050,000, but it would go to the children. It would not go to the grandchildren. The second exemption of $5,550,000, that would go into the generation skipping trust. So what would happen is, on that $16 million estate, roughly $2 million would be paid in taxes on the death of the second grandparent, of which $3 million would go to the children. However, the exemption amounts of $10.9 million would go to the grandchildren, completely skipping one whole generation from estate taxes. And this is what a lot of the wealthy families do. Jacqueline Kennedy did this on her death. She used generation skipping trust, as well as a wealth replacement trust. There are a number of things that you can do, but it's a very, very effective tool, especially when combined with things like the charitable remainder trust, wealth replacement trust. So these are just a couple of things that could be done. And it's very, very popular, especially with the larger families, especially founding families of Fortune 500, S&P 500 companies.
All right. So that brings us to two final trusts. The one is the wealth replacement trust, and the other is the charitable remainder trust.
The wealth replacement trust is essentially a separate trust where the children, or it could be even grandchildren, are the beneficiaries of a life insurance policy that is held in a trust. And what happens is, usually the parents or grandparents make gifts to this trust each year of income. And there's crummy provisions. There's a whole bunch of things. I'm not going to get into the technicalities. But then the trustee of this trust uses the income gifted from the parents to make the insurance premiums on the life insurance policy. Normally what we do when we set these up is we do something called the last survivor policy. It's a life insurance policy that's based on both the husband and the wife, and it only pays when the second spouse passes away. There's no payment of insurance on the death of the first spouse, because it's really done to replace assets lost due to estate taxes, or to provide liquidity in a family-run business where, you know, you don't want the heirs or the children to sell the business because you want that business to continue. Or let's say where you have large real estate holdings that are illiquid, you don't want to be in a situation where the heirs have to liquidate the properties in 9 months to pay the government the death tax. And so what happens is, let's say the parents make the gifts of the premium. The premiums are paid to the insurance company. There's all kinds of little legal technicalities that have to be followed. But here's the great part. Upon death of the second spouse, the life insurance company pays the proceeds of the life insurance policy into this trust. There are no income taxes and there are no estate taxes. So this can either provide liquidity to pay those estate taxes if the estate is illiquid, or it could be used to replace the assets that are going to be forfeited in the form of death taxes. So that's the wealth replacement trust. The other kind of trust is something called the charitable remainder trust. And this is very, very effective tool when used in combination with the wealth replacement trust. Essentially what happens is somebody has a business, they have large capital gain holdings, they have large capital gains in real estate. There's some technicalities when it comes to real estate. But basically what you do is you transfer the assets to the charitable remainder trust, and there's a couple things that happen. Number one, you get a big tax deduction for making the gift. Now, it's not as much as the total value of the asset transferred, because remember, the charity is not going to get the asset right away. They're only going to get the asset when the last spouse passes away, or even when you can even extend it on to the children. So you get a tax deduction up front. Inside the trust, you don't pay any capital gains taxes. So the trustee could buy and sell stocks. There's no capital gains. However, you do take a distribution from this trust, and it's taxed as ordinary income. It's usually fixed as a percentage. And then what happens, that would provide income to the beneficiaries that set up the trust, let's say the husband and wife in this case, for their entire lifetime. And then at their death, the assets would go to charity. Now, if you set up a charitable remainder trust, sometimes we'll set up a wealth replacement trust to replace the assets that went into the charitable remainder trust. So it's a very, very powerful combination, John, when used together. And as I mentioned, these are the type of things that you can do when you're dealing with estates that are $50 million or under. When you get over $50 million, you get into a whole separate category, foundations and generation skipping trusts, all kinds of things that you do to minimize gifting strategies, paying taxes up front, Q-tip trust, kind of the same kind of thing that Sam Walton did. But there's all kinds of things that can be done to minimize the impact, which is why you have some of these great families that are around today, like the Kennedys. You know, Joe Kennedy amassed the fortune. Now you have, what, 59 Kennedy families, third generation, that are living off these assets.
Okay, so as we look at the strategy for avoiding as much as you can in death taxes, for people who we would call zero percenters, that's an estate worth less than $5,450,000, you may still have probate expenses if you haven't taken the steps to avoid that, as well as capital gains tax and IRA taxes. So if you're above $5 million, you have different options, different trusts. There's an AB disclaimer trust, a Q-tip, generation skipping trust, wealth replacement trust, and a charitable remainder trust. And you need to evaluate which of these will fit your own particular situation. But the one thing you really have to think about is please plan. Because the government is moving in a more confiscatory direction, and therefore a lot more planning is needed if you're going to avoid paying a lot of taxes at the end. Now, let's look at a case study. We always provide a case study during this program. It's a real-life study. We just changed the names of the people involved to protect their privacy. I'm assuming this one stacked up, and they needed some trusts in order to make this all work.
This will get into some of the techniques we're talking about here. This is the case of David and Elaine Schwartz. David, age 67, founded a packaging company. It was a second marriage. David and Elaine had three children of their own, but David had one daughter prior to marrying Elaine. Elaine was age 60. Basically, David had started a packaging company, and the value of that company was worth roughly about $10 million. He had in pensions, IRAs, roughly about $2.5 million. in real estate, which consisted of commercial buildings, mainly from his business. Also a large ranch that was valued, real estate holdings were roughly about $8 million, and a tax-free bond portfolio worth roughly about $4 million for almost a $25 million estate. He was given an offer, which we helped negotiate, by a public company in Japan. This was a publicly traded company. It was all set up, so there was stock for stock, so there wasn't any capital gains on the sale of the company. And that's the same thing that happens to you as an investor. If you own shares of a company, ABC, and it gets taken over by another company, you get stock in that other company. As long as you hold the stock, there's no capital gains. The capital gains are paid only when you sell the share. So in this case, we made sure that everything was done in a C corporation. So it was stock for stock, in which case there was no capital gains when the company was taken over for stock. But more importantly, what we did is the capital gains on that estate, because basically he had no basis in his business. And on $10 million, the tax on that alone, federal and California taxes, would have been $3.7 million. So what we did is we transferred $10 million to a charitable remainder trust. And as a result of that, we saved $3.7 million, plus we got tax deductions worth close to $1.5 million that we would be able to use in other areas to offset income. The second thing we did is we set up a wealth replacement trust of $8 million that was funded with $100,000 of life insurance premiums, which David and Elaine would make to the trustee of that trust. And the policy, the $8 million policy, would go income tax and estate tax free to the heirs. Now, the other thing that we wanted to do, the $2.5 million in the IRA, we wanted to use a drawdown of that IRA over a five-year period of time, because we didn't want it to accumulate where it'd be subject to income taxes over a period of time. And we wanted to have some income to offset the tax deduction that we got from making the contribution to the charitable remainder trust. They named three charities in that trust. Each of them would get a third. So here we have this huge tax deduction. And that's a great thing about a charitable trust. Not only do you save on the capital gains taxes, which are really quite high if you live in a state like California, where the state tax rates are high, or you live in states like Hawaii, Oregon, New Jersey, New York, and some of the higher income tax states. So you save on capital gains taxes, and then you get a tax deduction that you can use, a charitable deduction, to offset against your income. So the plan was to take large distributions from the IRA using the tax savings from the charitable trust to offset some of the income and draw down that IRA over 5 years. As we draw down the IRA, we would rebuild the assets in the municipal bond portfolio, so that would get bigger. And then what we had is in the charitable trust, that's where we put bonds and dividend paying stocks at a distribution rate of about 4%. So they would be getting $400,000 during David's lifetime and Elaine's lifetime. So no matter if one spouse passed away, the surviving spouse would get the same level of income. And that 4% would be based on the value of the assets of the trust. So let's say in 10 years, that $10 million charitable trust grew to $15 million. They would be getting 4% of the $15 million, not the original 10. The other thing that we wanted to set up, because they had surplus income, is we set up a gifting program. They had 12 grandchildren with their four kids, and so we set up a gifting program for the grandchildren. So at death, and who knows where this estate will be in 10, 15 years, but based on where the assets are right now, the wealth replacement trust would fund $8 million. The B trust would be $5,450,000. The A trust would be $5,450,000. And the tax above that on the other assets, there would be roughly about a $1.5 million estate tax. But afterwards, there would be an additional almost $2.2 million. So the heirs would receive $21 million of almost a $25 million estate. And that may change down the road if the assets get bigger. We have contingency plans to do additional things depending on how the assets go. Now, the one problem that we had is we had almost $8 million in real estate, And what we don't want to do, because to shelter income from real estate, you use depreciation. So the basis in the property was high, and capital gains taxes on real estate are not 20%, they're 25% plus the Obamacare tax. So they're almost 28%. So the plan was the real estate would not be sold until the death of the first spouse, at which time, due to the stepped up basis and cost, all the capital gains would be forgiven. So the only gains for tax purposes would be in the A trust. The capital gains on the real estate would be eliminated on the death of the first spouse. That would eliminate the capital gains. We had a gifting program to give away excess income to the grandchildren. Both were healthy. Not only are they healthy, but especially on Elaine's side, my goodness, her mother lived into her 90s. So basically, you know, this estate could even get much bigger. So this is plan A. As the estate gets bigger, we will be resorting and doing more things. But down the road, we might even set up a foundation, a more wealth replacement, or even capital gains on the, let's say, another capital gains tax, if we decide to go in that direction, a charitable trust, and even add to it. So, but basically, personal income was generating from real estate substantial income. Now we had the charitable remainder trust. And of course, we had a $4 million tax-free bond portfolio that was generating a lot of income. But John, as it stands right now, close to 80% of this estate would pass on, or almost 90% of the estate would pass on to the heirs as a result of using a wealth replacement and a charitable remainder trust and an AB trust.
Coming up next, our guest for this week, Robin O'Brien, The Unhealthy Truth, what's in our food supply and how much do government regulators know about it and how is it affecting us? As Lifetime Income continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Well, we all know that the foods that we eat or digest are very important to our health. Despite being one of the most well-fed nations on the planet, many Americans are plagued with disease, everything from heart disease to diabetes to cancer to allergies. Joining me on the program today is the author of a new book called The Unhealthy Truth, One Mother's Shocking Investigation into the Dangers of America's Food Supply. Joining me on the program is its author, Robin O'Brien. And Robin, before we begin, I wonder if you'd give our listeners a little bit of a background of how you got involved in writing this book and into our food. I mean, you were a financial analyst in Food Writers. So why don't you give us a little bit of a background where you're coming from that led to the writing of this book?
Yeah, absolutely. It is not at all what I thought I would be doing with the rest of my life, but I grew up in Texas in a really conservative family. I went to business school on a full scholarship. I was recruited by Exxon and Enron out of business school. Wasn't interested in the oil and gas industry. I knew I tended to get bored easily, and so I was really interested in going to work for Wall Street. So I joined a team that managed $20 billion in assets, and as the only woman on the team, the guy said, you can cover the food industry. And I thought, you know, this is a terrible idea. I can't cook. I'm not interested in cooking. This is not my thing. They didn't really care. I was the new guy on the totem pole, so I covered the food industry. And so as I did, my only interest was in those financial models. I didn't really care. I wasn't personally passionate about it either way. Just figured, you know, what was on grocery store shelves was safe. And so, you know, for those years, I really just threw myself into learning the business models of the food industry, both the retailers and companies like Costco and Walmart and Safeway and Kroger, and then, you know, companies like Whole Foods and Wild Oats, the grocery stores that were starting to cater to organic consumers. Those were just starting to sort of come on the scenes in the late 1990s. And truly, Jim, I thought it was just a niche. I thought this is a great little marketing niche these guys have carved out. It's kind of lifestyle, the rich and famous, or some hippie thing. And I truly just looked at those categories as a niche. And then, you know, I love that job, truly love that job. We ended up relocating to Colorado at the same time we had our first child. And so I thought, I'll just take some time off. and I'll recruit one of the guys out to Colorado from Texas. And so, you know, I did. I spent some time trying to recruit one of the hedge fund managers that I'd worked with back out to Colorado, where he was originally from. And he came back, and, you know, we kind of plowed through starting the family, and we had four kids really quickly because I truly, truly wanted to go back into the financial world. I loved it. I loved the dynamics of it. I loved the pace of it. I loved the fact that we were meeting with management teams from a bunch of different industries every day. And then, you know, as life tends to teach us, just when you think you've got your plans mapped out, you know, life will throw you a curveball and introduce new plans. And that's what happened. And it happened 10 years ago, the morning that our youngest child, our fourth child, had an allergic reaction over breakfast.
And explain what happened with your child and how that changed. Because, you know, one of the things that you talk about in your book, a very disturbing trend that we've seen in the last 20 years, is the explosion in incidences of allergies, asthma, autism, ADHD among children. And kind of lead us to what you believe is leading to these high incidents of these kind of illnesses.
So, you know, as my youngest child had that allergic reaction, all I could think was I hadn't really taken that condition seriously. It seemed so foreign to me that a child would be allergic to food. It was really kind of difficult to comprehend. It wasn't something that any of us grew up with. You know, we all ate PB&Js and had cartons of milk. We weren't deathly allergic to those things. So to suddenly have this epidemic, you know, as an analyst and as a number cruncher, I just wanted to see the data. Because once, you know, I took her to the emergency room that day and she said, this looks like an allergic reaction. And she starts rattling off these statistics about food allergies. And all I'm thinking is, since when? Because we hadn't grown up knowing this many children that were struggling with this many conditions. And so I didn't want anybody to tell me anything. I just wanted to see the numbers because I knew the numbers would tell their own story. And so I started digging into the numbers on food allergies. And what's interesting is the CDC doesn't actually count the number of people with food allergies. What they do count are things like the number of people that check into the emergency room with a life-threatening allergic reaction. And so I had to collect the data. And as I did, I realized that 1 in 13 children in the United States now has a food allergy. 1 in 10 now has asthma. Today, 1 in 45 now has autism. The CDC also reports that 1 in 3 Caucasian kids born in the year 2000, which is my daughter's 10th grade class, and 1 in 2 minority kids born in the year 2000 are expected to be insulin dependent by the time they reach adulthood. So I'm starting to look at this data and I'm like, this isn't just food allergies that are impacting these kids. You look at all of these statistics and put them side by side by side, and it comes out that 1 in 3 children now has autism, allergies, ADHD, or asthma. And so, you know, again, I was like, I have to back this somehow. Like, how can I support this? And if you turn to look at the escalating use of prescription drugs in children of this generation of kids has earned the title of Generation RX, and it's because a brand like EpiPen, which is the emergency device used to treat a life-threatening allergic reaction, was acquired for $200 million by a pharmaceutical company in 2007, and today it's a billion-dollar brand. And if you look at hospitalizations that relate to food allergic reactions from 1997 to 2007, there was a 265% increase in the rate of hospitalizations related to food allergic reactions. So this is data. You know, it's not somebody claiming a sensitivity or claiming their child's allergic. This was data that was provided, you know, out of government statistics. And again, that's why I'm so thankful for this really conservative, financially educated part of me, because those were the numbers that I would rely on. And so as I started looking at this data, it's just what has changed. And as I started to kind of try to understand what was going on in the food, I realized that as an analyst, you know, I had strictly asked questions that related to the numbers, margins, profitability, earnings, revenue, all that. And I could see how we had taken out real ingredients and replaced them with these artificial ingredients to help drive margins. I mean, it made a lot of sense as a business model. But what I had not thought to ask at that time was, what are all of these artificial ingredients doing in combination? What do they do together? And unfortunately, those studies have not yet been conducted. And so what happened is, as we started introducing a lot of these artificial ingredients into our food supply, and some of them, you know, was in the 1970s, things like high fructose corn syrup. Some things, like in the 1980s, became really pervasive, like artificial dyes. And then some things in the 1990s, like these genetically engineered ingredients and artificial growth hormones. And so as we were introducing these things, I thought, you know, well, what else is happening around the world? Because in having covered the food industry, I knew that craft doesn't just get their revenue from here in the United States. You know, they're selling overseas. And I think probably still to this day, one of the most stunning things to learn was that our American food companies formulate their products differently for consumers in other countries. So Kraft and Coca-Cola and Walmart and General Mills, they formulate without these artificial ingredients overseas. They don't use artificial food colors because of the concern of the link to hyperactivity. They just use natural food coloring. They don't use artificial growth hormones because of health concerns around that product in the dairy. Here in the United States, we're the only developed country in the world that's allowed for this artificial growth hormone in our dairy. And so that double standard just kept kicking at me, you know, and it was across the board. It was things like when genetically engineered ingredients were introduced in the United States in the 1990s. Today, over 35 countries around the world have banned those ingredients, and for 60% of the world's population, those things are labeled. And yet here in the United States, we're still trying to fight to even know that it's in our food. And so that double standard really was my moment where I thought, I can't not talk about this. Americans have the right to know how their food is made and how their food is produced so that we can take personal responsibility for our health. And as I looked at the data of what was happening to the health of the children, you know, all of a sudden I thought, like, what is this doing to our economy? How big of a hit is this on our economy if our kids have this title of Generation RX? And so I turned to sources like the CIA, the United Nations, and they rank things like life expectancy at birth. They rank things like percentage of GDP spent on healthcare and disease management versus our trading partners. And the United States spends more on healthcare and disease management than any other country on the planet. Between 18 and 20 cents of every dollar circulating in our economy, it's now being spent on healthcare and disease. And so that comes out to about $9,000 per American around the country, whereas our trading partners in countries around the world, the average is about $3,500. So we are spending so much more money, so much more of our economy, you know, so much more of our GDP is now being spent managing disease and on healthcare costs. And so the American, like the patriot in me, just went off on that because I thought, how can we drive our earnings? How can we drive our success towards our core competencies? How can we increase innovation? How can we drive entrepreneurship? How can we drive productivity and creativity? How can we lead in the global marketplace if we are this sick? And that today is why I do the work today, because I think the data that we now have in front of us does not reflect who we are as a country, and it doesn't reflect who we want to be, what we know we're capable of being. And I think about how our country was founded by these families with this pioneering entrepreneurial spirit to create a better way. When they saw that something was wrong, they built a better way. And I think that's the opportunity in front of us today.
Why do you think, Robin, that in these other countries, you'll take a company like Kraft, that if they're making packaged products that they're going to sell in Europe elsewhere, they don't put the dyes, the kind of preservatives and the kind of toxins in their food. Is it lobbying efforts here, or is it just lack of education here that we're not doing more about this?
You know, I think initially it was a bit of both. And the lobbying efforts are absolutely enormous, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth by the Grocery Manufacturers Association. And, you know, at this point, enough of the Grocery Manufacturers Association members have actually peeled away from that organization and said, you know what, it's stupid of us not to stand with our consumer. We're standing with the consumer. And the most recent example of that is Campbell's. Campbell's just said, you know what, we do believe in mandatory labeling of GMOs. They're already doing it around the world. And they're going to stand by the Americans and say, hey, we're going to do it here now, too. And I think what's fascinating is that the Grocery Manufacturers Association, as it existed in the 20th century, it may have worked. But it's not working. Not only is it not working for consumers, it's not working for its members anymore either. And, you know, now they've got huge earnings problems because they haven't been transparent about how their food is made. They've got, you know, huge growth issues where, you know, they're just barely stagnant, you know, trying to kind of hold ground and not lose market share, whereas the organic industry, while it's only 5% of total industry of food and beverage, it's growing at 12 to 14% a year. So it's absolutely where the growth is. And I think that's why you're starting to see these big corporations acquire these little organic companies. And I think the lobbying efforts have totally backfired because they were able to sort of keep Congress in the dark on this issue. But the consumer, and thankfully, you know, with social media and the internet, with all this access we now have to information, the consumer was able to get the information that she needed. And again, it, to me, it just comes back to that double standard. You know, this isn't anti-science. This is consumers saying, We deserve the same value placed on the lives of our families that you, Coca-Cola, and other corporations have already placed on the lives of families overseas. So it's very pro-transparency. It's very pro-science. I think by labeling these ingredients, we're allowed to collect more data. We're allowed to collect more science, you know, because right now they say there's no evidence of harm. And if you're not labeling things like GMOs, you just flat out don't have any evidence. And so, you know, consumers are saying at this point, with 1 in 2 men expected to get cancer in their lifetime, 1 in 3 women expected to get cancer in their lifetime, and cancer now the leading cause of death by disease in children, the American families are saying, we need to know how our food is made, we need to know what is in it, so that we can protect the health of the people that we love.
Robin, what do you think gave rise to all the kind of food additives and genetic modifications that have become part of our food supply in recent decades? I mean, you know, right now everybody knows salmon is good for you, but now we have farm-raised salmon, and people don't realize that the salmon they're buying in the store may have food coloring to make it look like salmon, and some of those food colorings may not be healthy.
You raise such a good point, because I do think the lobbying efforts have been so influential here. And, you know, to a certain extent, the messages that the media is allowed to convey are governed by their advertisers. And so Pepsi and Coke and Kraft and, you know, some of these chemical companies are the lead advertisers for, you know, a network or for a newspaper. The newspaper, to a certain extent, can only say so much. And I think if you go overseas again, where these American corporations don't have that same kind of influence over the media and over the messaging, they have a much more robust dialogue and a much more robust conversation overseas than they do here. And so when GMOs were first being introduced, it was all over the press in Europe. And Europe just, they freaked out. They said, you know, we don't know what the long-term consequences of this might be. And when you really look at, you know, the early introduction of GMOs, the first few products that were introduced by the chemical companies were seeds that were designed and engineered to withstand increasing applications of their weed killer Roundup, and they were called Roundup Ready seeds. Any parent knows that, you know, you're told not to keep Roundup in your kitchen. You're told not to store that under your kitchen sink because you're supposed to keep it out of the reach of children, and yet increasing amounts of that product are what has been sprayed on our food supply. So, you know, now you start to see countries saying, not only do we want this stuff labeled, but we want that key ingredient, glyphosate, that's found in Roundup, we want it banned. Because just last year, the World Health Organization came out saying it's a probable carcinogen. So, you know, again, there's a transparency and there's a robust conversation that's happening around the world on these issues, obviously, because it is critical to the health of a population. And yet here in the United States, a lot of times what happens, and, you know, I've definitely experienced this, is people that raise these issues, they try to dismiss it, they try to marginalize it. And I think, you know, to me, I keep coming back to, this is one of the greatest human rights issues of our time, is to understand how our food is made, to know what's being applied to it, to know that these ingredients that are being applied to it are a probable carcinogen, so that you can choose, because then you can take personal responsibility for your health.
You know, it's amazing, too, because I'm doing a special on the show on the government's budget. 28% goes to health care, and we're dealing with issues that you're talking about here because so many Americans are subject to diseases you don't see as prevalent overseas, whether it's heart disease, cancer, or things like diabetes. I want to talk about the growing movement to organic foods. You're seeing it in the popularity of such, you know, supermarket chains such as Whole Foods, and even companies like Costco now are starting to add more organic type foods. Is organic farming a panacea for these issues? And how can it become really more affordable?
That is a great question, and that is also why I'm going to be doing this work until I have a silver ponytail, because we need to refinance the farms. And right now, like you highlighted before, if 28% of the federal budget is going towards health care, the percentage that's going to support this chemically intensive operating system on the farm is huge. And organic farmers, by law, are not allowed to use that chemically intensive operating system. They're not allowed by law to use GMOs and all those synthetic pesticides that are applied. And yet the farmers that are using the chemically intensive system receive the subsidies you know, the whole farm bill discussion, the subsidies, they receive marketing support, they receive crop insurance support. So their whole cost of production is subsidized and supported. They have financial aid. The organic farmers, by law, are not allowed to use those things. They don't receive the subsidies, they don't receive the marketing support, and they don't receive the crop insurance. So they don't have any form of financial aid. And when you talk to these farmers, a lot of the farmers aren't even that big of a fan of the subsidies in the first place. So if you could level the playing field at the farm, if you had just neutrality at the farm, and the farmers didn't have to make a decision based on any kind of financial bonus that they would receive one way or the other, you'd start to see, you know, a different operating system at that level, which obviously then would flow through all the way to the consumer. But a huge constraint that we've got here in the United States, and part of it is a function of this farm bill, is the fact that less than 1% of U.S. farmland is organic. And so right now you've got trade agreements that are happening between Mexico and Europe and other countries around the world around organic produce. And here in the United States, we have not invested in that. And again, as somebody who studied business, that's crazy to me, because if it were any other industry that had the kind of growth that we're seeing, like we're seeing in the organic industry, there'd be just this huge move to support that. And yet here in the United States, you know, we get back to the lobbying issue. The argument is made that, you know, you only need one chemically intensive operating system. That's the only answer for feeding the world. And that is just not true. The United States Department of Agriculture, the United Nations have both highlighted that 30 to 40% of the food that we grow and produce is thrown away, completely wasted. So we've got a distribution problem first. And then you can take the technology that we have learned in the 21st century. You can apply that technology to these organic farming systems. You can use less chemically intensive operating systems. And again, the UN came out with a report saying we need a toolbox of resources to address, you know, these different challenges of feeding the world.
Robin, before we get on to maybe what our listeners can do in gaining their own health, let's talk about two things. How does the body's immune system react to these GMO or genetically modified foods and the pesticides, the toxins that they're digesting? Because you mentioned a couple things that we're starting to see more incidents of: allergies, asthma, autism, ADHD among our children. And so, you know, the one thing that at least I have learned, the food that we're eating today, unless you're eating organic food, is much different than the food we were eating in this country 40, 50 years ago.
You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, what's deceptive is that the box of mac and cheese hasn't changed that much in its appearance. But what's changed is that you have artificial dyes in there. You have artificial growth hormones in the dairy. You have genetically engineered ingredients and the increasing amounts of things like Roundup. So the box hasn't changed, but there's been a fundamental change in the way that we produce our food. And I think, you know, there are doctors that are saying, and, you know, these guys are some of the bravest that there are, because when they come out, of course, they are just slandered. But the doctors are saying, you know, 70 to 80% of our immune system is found in our digestive tract. And so if we're ingesting all of these artificial ingredients and all of these synthetic chemicals, you know, the pipes can be corroded, like any pipes can be corroded, and that's referred to as leaky gut. And then you're opening, you know, your system to a whole bunch of different issues. And when it comes to the genetically engineered products, I mean, they're not knowingly going to insert a known allergen into that new genetically engineered product. But what scientists are concerned with is the imprecision in the process. And so where the companies that are manufacturing these things would want to say it's very precise, you know, scientists that are independent are saying it's like a shotgun and it creates this genetic rubble. And those pieces, that rubble, there aren't even names for those pieces. And so what is our body responding to? Is it responding to this new protein that's been introduced? Is it responding to the genetic rubble that's been introduced? And those are the answers that we don't have. And those are also the reasons that countries around the world, all of our key trading partners, said, we're just going to label these products, we're going to label these ingredients so that we can have a traceability, so that we can have an accountability in the marketplace. But here in the United States, since they're not labeled, there is no way to conduct a post-market surveillance study to determine whether or not these things are contributing to things like food allergies. So, you know, I tend to joke, I'm like, if you're on the board of one of these chemical companies, this is a brilliant business model. You've genetically engineered the seed so that you can sell more of those chemicals. And as you look at those revenue models, you know, the agrochemical sector took off in those earnings models. And then on top of that, the product isn't labeled in the marketplace, so there's no way to have traceability, accountability, or liability should they ever be proven to cause harm.
So given all this, what is the average person listening to, for example, this broadcast? How do you begin the process of reducing or eliminating exposure to all these environmental toxins that we're digesting in our food supply?
You know, it's a great question, and thankfully there's a lot that you can do, and thankfully this movement has hit the mainstream. So, you know, by law, organic food is not allowed to have these artificial ingredients, things like artificial dyes, things like artificial growth hormones, things like GMOs, and things like this synthetic weed killer that's just been declared a probable carcinogen. By law, organic is not allowed to have those things. So thankfully, you know, like you mentioned, Costco, Walmart, Safeway, Kroger, Whole Foods, obviously, I mean, these stores around the country are offering more and more organic food because they realize that consumers are saying, I just want to opt out of this thing. I want to get out of this experiment. I don't want to be feeding my family all these artificial ingredients anymore. We're battling with pick your condition. Every family in America knows somebody that has one of these conditions, whether it's diabetes or cancer or Alzheimer's or autism. It's driving this food awakening where all of a sudden all of us are starting to flip that box over and say, you know, what is this stuff? What's in here? And then when you layer on the fact that we have this double standard where our own food companies are already producing the products without these artificial ingredients, then, you know, it's time for them to step up and do the same thing here. So what I would encourage people to do is, if you got little kids, keeping them off artificial dyes really does do a lot for managing hyperactivity. There was a study done in the UK called the Southampton study that was so compelling and so conclusive that all of our American food companies voluntarily agreed to remove artificial dyes from the products they sell overseas. So that's a great one for parents of little kids. Artificial growth hormone, which is known as RBGH, that's found in a lot of conventional milk and cheese and ice cream. By law, that's not allowed in countries around the world, any other developed country. We are the only developed country that allowed it. There were a lot of health concerns around that artificial growth hormone. So look for milk that is labeled RBGH-free, and by law, organic milk cannot contain it. So that's another way to navigate your dairy. And then the GMO thing is fascinating to me. There's been so much noise around it at the state level with states trying to introduce labeling initiatives. And what's fascinating to me is that the food companies and the retailers are hearing the consumer loud and clear. And last year, 45% of all new product launches in the United States were non-GMO. So this is across the board. General Mills, Campbell's, Whole Foods, Stonyfield, Annie's, all the companies now are saying, we're opting out of this thing. It's clear consumers don't want GMOs. And I think when you look at any other industry, the corporations always respond to the consumer. You know, whether it's a car manufacturer, whether it's a computer company, the computer companies, if there's something inside one of their computers, they label it for their consumers. And the greatest campaign in that space was Intel Inside. Intel was so proud to tell you that they're inside all of these different systems. And so I think this kind of call for labeling of, you know, we want to know if there's GMO inside. The GMO inside, that's the same call, you know, for transparency. And I think it's very American. You know, we want that fundamental freedom. We want that right to choose.
Finally, I guess a question. What's it like to take on some very powerful and entrenched interest, both not only in business, but even in government? Many times, a lot of government agencies are very protective of a lot of these companies that spend a lot of money on lobbyists.
You know, those are great questions. And, you know, as somebody who is in the finance world, you're a number cruncher. And so there's something very introverted in that that I love. So I have been outside of my comfort zone 1,000 times in the last 10 years of this work. And I have seen things that I never wanted to see. I've come to understand things that, you know, I know we need to reverse. And unfortunately, you know, there are a lot of people inside the government on this particular issue who once worked for these chemical companies. And so, you know, they're in there to protect the status quo. What I think is fascinating is that you can drive change through the marketplace a lot faster than you can drive change through Washington, D.C. And I think it's broken on both sides. You know, we have a system now where the corporations hold such tremendous sway. And as long as you are strong enough to just call a spade and say that's what it is, how do we drive change through the marketplace? you drive change through the marketplace, and then policy will follow the money. Policy always follows the money. So, yes, there are very entrenched corporations. Yes, they are hugely intimidating. But at this point now, you know, we have built a movement, and the retailers understand that. Kroger, they launched their own private label product, the Simple Truth product line that's free from a bunch of artificial ingredients. They've got Simple Truth Organic, which is free from GMOs and all these artificial ingredients. That product line went from zero to $1 billion in revenue in a two-year period. And again, numbers tell their own story. So I think the consumers are on the right side of this. I love that companies are stepping out and standing with us now. I think that's only going to continue. I think the Grocery Manufacturers Association at this point is more of a relic of the 20th century that's no longer meeting the needs of its business partners. And I really think that what's in front of us is wide open. There's so much opportunity for entrepreneurs. There's so much opportunity for venture capital money. There's so much opportunity for people to get involved in any way at every level. And I think that's a really exciting thing. And I also just come back to this patriotism. I just think we have to do this. As Americans, we have to take back our health.
You know, it's amazing. I keep thinking there's a big opportunity, just as we've seen the rise of companies or grocery chains like Whole Foods. There's local ones here in California. But I think there's a big opportunity for somebody to come up with a fast food chain that is actually healthy.
You know, they're starting to. And, you know, what's interesting is that it's a lot of former McDonald's guys that have now kind of, they have seen the light, or, you know, my wife was trying to tell me this 10 years ago, or, you know, they have the funniest stories. But, you know, there's a former McDonald's guy who now is part of a big meatless company. You've got a guy that was once with Coca-Cola who's now chairman of the board of a meatless company. You've got Amy's, which has been a really popular organic food product in the grocery store. They've just launched the first organic drive-through on the West Coast. You've got little restaurants like Life Kitchen, same idea. It's fast, casual, healthy, organic food. And I think, again, it's this opportunity in front of us is huge. But what we really, really have to address to make it wildly successful are these constraints we have over our supply chain right now, and the fact that less than 1% of all U.S. farmland is organic. Because I look at that and I think we're outsourcing this opportunity. Right now, these companies that are growing like crazy have to go to Australia and Uruguay and China and Romania to get their supply. And that, to me, you know, it makes no sense. It's lost economic opportunities, lost economic upside. It's lost opportunity for our farmers. So, you know, to really start at the farm, to refinance the farm, so that we can grow this movement.
Well, listen, Robin, I appreciate you coming on the program. A great, great book. The name of the book is called The Unhealthy Truth by Robin O'Brien. And Robin, any chance, I think you and I were talking earlier before we went on the air, of making this book into a documentary, because this story really needs to get out there.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I definitely have had a lot of people that have been interested in that in the past. It, again, is a strange feeling to suddenly be on the front of a movement when you're used to being behind four or five computer terminals. So to find the right partner for that, to me, is incredibly important. And I have turned down probably a dozen people who have approached over the years, you know, with a serious kind of proposal on it, because either the time wasn't right, or the tone wasn't going to be right, or the ability to really control how the story was told wasn't right. So it is so important, but it is also so important that it be delivered accurately, and that the story is told in a way that inspires the people that watch it and helps to, you know, further inspire this movement.
Well, listen, my compliments and my hats off to you for taking on this project and getting the information out to a lot of us consumers out there, because one of the things that we discussed is, you know, people know that salmon or fish is very healthy, but then when you take a look at a lot of this farm-raised fish, you find out that they're feeding it things that don't make it as healthy as the regular salmon that's caught out in the wild. And then on top of that, the food dyes that they're putting in to make it look like salmon. Once again, that book is called The Unhealthy Truth by Robin O'Brien. Robin, all the best.
Thank you.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, that you can actually solve a lot of health problems or prevent health problems by watching what you eat, just shifting your diet. And everybody has cheaters, what I call them. I mean, you go on a diet where generally during the week you're behaving yourself, and then maybe on a weekend you'll allow yourself a day.
And the weekends, yeah, or holidays.
But everywhere, what we, since given in my part of the country, I can do this, we buy a cow every year. And then we divide it up between three families, but it's very, very cheap for our own meat. And the difference is it's grass-fed beef. And the amazing thing is when you like fry up hamburger meat, the very little amount of fat that comes off of it compared to one on those few occasions we've actually run out until the next cow came along and we had to go buy some from the store. And we go, wow, look at this difference. It's just amazing. Just that alone.
I forget, you were telling me one day, what do you pay per pound by the time you get the cow and you have to pay for butchering it, packing it? I mean, it was an incredible price because I picked up grass-fed fillets at Whole Foods this weekend and they were $30 a pound.
Okay, well, we pay by the time we purchase the animal and then whatever its upkeep is during the summer and then pay for the butchering and the meat cutting and everything, it's about $3.50 a pound. Now, that's averaged out over, you name it, steaks, ribs, hamburger meat, you know, roasts, the whole thing. But it averages out to about $3.50 a pound. But we can do that because we're in a part of the country where I know the guy who's doing it. You know, I know him directly and we arrange for it. So I can see where if you live in cities, it's going to be harder to do that.
That is absolutely amazing. You're getting your grass-fed beef at roughly 10% of what I'm paying at the supermarket.
Yeah, because you have to have all these people deliver it to where you are. You know, there's a markup each time you do it. We go direct. As a matter of fact, the cow lives about a mile from the studio here.
So you can see the cow you're going to eat.
Yes, we... My daughter used to say things like, we're waiting for you for Christmas, you know, or something like that. But we can see that. And then we actually go pick the meat up from the butchers. You know, they have a place where the butchering's done and the meat's dressed and cut the way you want it. And we actually go up there. We have a, you know, it's something that Carol and I do every single year is we go up and get the meat and we bring it back. And then the three families involved in it have to come over and because it's super frozen by that time. And, you know, and it takes about two freezers worth to hold the animal, which means you also have to have a generator here because if you lose power for a long period of time, you know, that's a year's worth of beef. I forget what the total poundage is.
Yeah, this is something that we're considering. We're thinking of getting a deep freezer and we're going to try to find out between my kids and myself of doing the same thing you're doing because the price, I mean, if you want to get organic beef in the store, it's very expensive. $3 a pound versus 30. I'll take that any day. And by the way, the book Unhealthy Truth, read this. You will be surprised, folks, at the kind of stuff, the toxins that they're putting in the foods that you eat. You have no idea of the kind of poisons that you're eating. And then we wonder why we have allergy, ADHD, we have asthma, all these kind of things that we're running into. This book will give you a good idea and how you can correct it. Well, we're out of time here on today's Lifetime Income. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the show. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.